Welcome to BCA Podcast, a podcast hosted by Anna Barroso and Jonathan Melville. Hello, Jonathan. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. Very good. Very excited. How are you?
That's really good. I'm also really excited. This is going to be our first episode of this podcast. So I think it would be good to introduce ourselves a bit. My name is Anna Barroso. I'm from Spain and I'm a trail runner. And then on my left, who do we have?
Yeah, I'm Jonathan Melville. I run BCA. I'm the founder of it and the head coach. I'm also a PhD student at Anglia Ruskin and I research marathon running.
That's really good. As you can see, this is going to be quite an interesting podcast as we can talk from the experience of being a coach of endurance sports and an athlete. So I'm basically the one who knows nothing about all of these topics. I just do what I'm told to do by my coach, which, who is it?
Well, that's me. Yeah. I mean, you do ask some good questions though, and hopefully we're going to bring that to the podcast as well.
That's nice. So I'm basically going to be like probably the vast majority of you, like the audience, knowing nothing and having all the questions. And it's probably going to be the same that you all are like wondering what you could be doing right or maybe what you could be doing wrong and how to fix that. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic here. I think this is going to be really...
I'm going to get a bunch of difficult questions that I might not know the answer to, but no, it'll be good. It'll be
very good. Yeah. And we're going to divide this into different sections, this podcast. We're going to start by the news. This is basically a summary of some recent event news about sports. Usually we're going to cover three main sports. We might be discussing a bit more as long as we are talking, but there are going to be triathlon, there are going to be also cycling and running. Those three are going to be the main focus, but we tend to talk a lot. We're quite chatty, so we probably end up talking about something completely different, but that's okay, that's okay. Then we're also going to cover some analysis of some material that maybe you could be using or material that you'd be thinking about buying and you are not sure, so we're going to give you some knowledge on that from the athlete perspective and from the coach perspective. And then also some interviews. In this case, at least during the first few episodes, it's going to be between us, athletes and coach, as I think it's going to be the thing that you're all going to be like most interested about because it's going to be the reality of the vast majority of people, right?
Yeah.
Should we start with the first one?
Yeah, I'm happy to start.
Right. So what do we have today on the news? I think the first thing to start is going to be with a recent, really, really recent news, which is related to the triathlon world. The triathlon legend Daniela Ryf, she's announcing that she's retiring. Mm-hmm. After, like, how old is she? 36 years old.
Yeah. So Daniela Ryf is a really remarkable triathlete. She's won, I think, 4 or 5 Ironman World Championships, 1 silver medal. Her last World Championships coming back, I think, in 2019. So not too long ago. But yeah, 36 years old. She's decided maybe it's time she's had enough of battering her body every day.
I mean, it's a long way. It's a long way to come here. But the shocking thing is that nowadays the athletes, they are prolonging their careers for longer. And it's not unusual having athletes that are in their late 30s or even early 40s. Or even some of them, even in their 50s, still doing these amazing things. What do you think that could be?
Well, it's definitely true that, at least in the media, we're seeing a lot more athletes that are in their mid to late 30s and still performing at the top level. So some really big examples are American football player Tom Brady, football player Cristiano Ronaldo. Tom Brady went till, I think, he was 40, Ronaldo's 39. There's even a player in the Japanese Premier League in football who's now 50 years old, and he's still playing professionally, which is absolutely remarkable. So that we are seeing, at least in the media, that 40 is becoming the new 30, because they used to say once you hit 30, your career was only going to go downhill. But actually, it seems that doesn't have to be the case. Why this is the case? Well, firstly, I don't technically know if it's the case or if it's just the media that makes it seem like it. Maybe is it all these new recovery aids that we've developed with technology that allow us to prolong our careers? Because when we talk about sport, we talk about improving our performance and getting faster, or you know, jumping further, for example. But you don't necessarily hear people talk about it in terms of improving our longevity of our career, because that's also really important. The longer you can go, the more you can get out of yourself. So if you're, let's say you're a football club and you pay a certain amount of money for a player, well, if you know with new technology, we can prolong that player's career, you're actually going to get more value for that athlete, if you think about it. So it's really important that we look at why people, at least it seems, people are performing at a high level, even late into their 30s.
Yeah. I mean, just another news that we have is that, just look at Kipchoge.
Yeah.
How old is he?
39. Mm. Yeah.
He's still there. I mean, he's not, at least in the past few races, he's not performing as his best.
So Kipchoge, for context, finished 10th in Tokyo Marathon just last week. And that was his worst ever placing in a marathon. He did it about 2 hours, 6 minutes. And he was quite a way off the winner. I think he was beginning to drop off the pace before even halfway. Now, a lot of people are saying that, okay, maybe Kipchoge needs to look at retirement. Maybe, you know, people even saying maybe he shouldn't even be selected for the Kenyan Olympic team, which is a big statement to say for a guy about Kipchoge, right? But that's what people are saying. And the way I look at it is, maybe he is, you know, he's definitely at the back end of his career. He's certainly not at the beginning of it. But the way I look at this and go, well, he's 39. He probably knows he's limited to doing one really good marathon a year. He's not young anymore. His recovery time is not going to be as quick. So he probably knows he can only train himself to peak once. And of course, this year, there's a big thing to peak for. It's called the Olympics this year, this summer, right? So he's probably looking at this thinking, okay, yeah, I didn't have a good day in Tokyo, but why would I? I'm not peaking for Tokyo, I'm peaking for the summer. So maybe he's just building himself up to his peak slower than what he normally would, because he knows he might only have one peak in him potentially. Because when you're younger, you can get away with doing 2, possibly 3 marathons. But Kipchoge, maybe he's just holding himself back a little bit. So I would not write off Kipchoge just yet, particularly when he's done what he's done in his career. He's obviously mentally very resilient. A result like this isn't going to faze him too much. He probably knows what he's doing. Him and his coach knows what he's doing. So they're probably just saving him up and building him even slower. So when he comes to Paris, he's in his best shape.
And what do you think how Paris is going to be look like? Because he broke the 2-hour record, but that was not an official race.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he's going to try to do that on Paris, or too old for that?
Well, the Paris course isn't, I don't think, a particularly quick marathon. And not only that, but the marathons in the Olympics tend to be a lot slower.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they tend to be a lot slower is because they're done in the summer. And the summer, it's a lot hotter. So marathons, all the major marathons, are either in spring or autumn because the temperatures are a bit cooler. So, but in Rio or in Tokyo last year, it was very, very hot and the times were a lot slower. It's a lot slower relative to what these guys have and can do. So no one's breaking the sub 2-hour barrier in the Olympics, and at least not for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Kipchoge can break sub 2 in a normal event. For example, in Berlin last year, one of the majors, the fastest major marathon, typically where all the world records are broken, he won that race, which went a little bit under the radar. So it was only a year ago, he was still winning races. His time was quite a long way off the world record he set at Berlin not long before that. So I don't think Kipchoge is going to break any world records, but maybe as a one-off, he can still win the Olympics.
Yeah, because he's competing at a really high level still, even on that age. And there's really young runners. Sadly, one of them passed away a couple of weeks ago, I think it was. Yeah. The 23-year-old guy in a car accident.
Yeah.
But he was aiming for a lot, and everyone had a lot of hopes on him. So he's not the only one. There's going to be more people coming and coming.
Yeah, well, the marathon, the elite marathon population is actually becoming really fast. So they recently changed the Olympic qualification time from 2 hours, 11 minutes and 30 seconds, at least for men anyway. I'm not sure what it is for women. But for men, it was 2 hours, 11 minutes, 30 seconds. So quite quick. But they've reduced that to 2 hours and 8 minutes now, I believe, which is a big it's a big difference. But in Japan, there was a race, I don't remember when, within the last 6 months, where something like all of the top 15 went sub 2 hours, 6 minutes. Something unbelievably quick. And you don't get that many people in one race doing that quickly. So the marathon population might be getting quicker, at least at the elite end anyway.
And do you think it has something to do with their genetics or the body types? Because all of them, they come from those countries. Vast majority are from Kenya.
Well, so actually, when you look at Kenyan runners, everyone kind of thinks, oh, genetically the Kenyan runners are more advanced. Actually, it doesn't seem that genetics plays that big a factor in the reason why the Kenyan runners are really good, or the Ethiopian and Ugandan runners, East Africa. Actually, it seems some of the reasons are things like very simple things, actually, that can almost be applied to any country, is the distance that it took them to run to school every day. So if the further you lived away from school, the more likely you were to be a good marathon runner in those countries, because they don't really have cars and stuff. They ran to school. So if you were running more than your friends to school, say you live 10 miles away instead of 5 miles away, you were more likely to be a top marathon runner when you were older. And there's no reason, now maybe you shouldn't be asking your kids to run 10 miles to school every day, but my point is, it's these early workouts, if you will, that seem to have resulted in, have a compounding effect, the result in them being so good. Of course, there are other big advantages in Kenya. A lot of them will live at altitude. There's the obvious advantage to that, which we can't all control for. But actually, yeah, it might not necessarily just be genetics. It seems that might not be the case.
No. So would you say that everyone could be able to achieve that if they're training since a young age?
Good question. So the way I see it is, you don't need to be physiologically perfect to be a top, to be an elite athlete. You don't need to be perfect. Firstly, no one can have the perfect physiology for anything. But you do need to have the right physiology. So for example, Usain Bolt would probably never be a super quick marathon runner. Just probably wouldn't happen. But he could be a very good sprinter. And the way I think is, look, if you have the right physiology, then you can excel in that sport if you are committed. So you are putting in the right hours. And if you are, you don't need to specialize in the sport from a young age, but doing it from a young age will help you. So yeah, that's the way I see it. You don't need to be perfect, but you need to be right. For example, if you want to be, say, a goalkeeper in football, you have to be tall because the goals are very big. And if you're not tall, then you're not made of the right stuff. But there are other sports where you don't need to be. And those sports could be better for you, for example. So that's kind of the way I see it, yeah.
And how about not training since a young age? Like coming into your early 20s or even late 20s. There's a lot of people that are taking running nowadays. And they're getting really good marks and timings. Is it possible to actually achieve something without being born or being since a young age training for it?
So with certain sports, the answer seems to be no. So there are certain sports, gymnastics is one of them, figure skating is another one. You have to have had specialized from a really young age. So the peak age of those athletes is super young. In fact, 15-year-old girls are going to the Olympics, which is incredibly young. But if you want to, say, take up running, you can still be a good runner if you haven't had much history in training or in exercise up until that point. It's going to have helped you. So if you've played a variety of sports, say you played rugby, you played football, it's going to help you when you start running, because the people who did a variety of sports from a younger age tend to get less injuries when they start doing a new sport because their body is a bit more robust from all the different stimulus that they've had. So it's not a necessity, but if you are really motivated to say be a world champion, like Eliud Kipchoge or the Daniela Ironman world champion that we've talked about, then you're probably going to need to have had a good history behind you of training, and then you will need to continue to do that.
And I think that I've just realized is that we're not really introducing the people that we're talking about. Maybe someone has never heard about Adapta, but maybe no one has heard about these names. But Daniela Arif, yeah, we said that she was a triathlete. Mm-hmm. But for Eliud Kipchoge, I mean, who is he? I guess everyone knows, but maybe there's someone that
the
like,
man who needs no introduction.
Man?
Yeah. I mean, Kipchoge, he's Kenyan runner, 2-time Olympic champion. He has won Berlin, I want to say 4 times. I think he's won London. Does he need an introduction? he's the marathon runner. Yeah. I mean, it is. I can't unfortunately pronounce or read his name, but the Kenyan runner that, funnily enough, just got sponsored by Hoka, mm-hmm, as they released that new super shoe, tragically died. His time was scary remarkable. And I think Lord Co, who's the head of the IAAF, I think it was either him or Kipchoge said him running sub 2 hours in a competition was inevitable. I mean, it's 35 seconds off. That's just over a second per mile. You know, it's not, he's so close to that it was scary. But Kipchoge, actually, before this chap came up, he was promoting this Ugandan runner who is a world record holder in the 5 or 10,000 meters, has Olympic gold medals from Tokyo in these events, and he was transitioning to the marathon, and Kipchoge was backing him to become a really good marathon runner because of he's got good history, he can handle the pressure of this kind of thing, he is a champion, he's already Olympic champion, so maybe he's the next one to take the baton, so to speak. Because the amazing thing I find about Kipchoge was at the London Olympics in 2012, which was a huge Olympics, Kipchoge didn't go. He wasn't in the Kenyan team. He was meant to be, he was a 5,000 and 10,000 meter runner. Didn't get chosen for the Kenyan team. So he went, I'm going to be a marathon runner then. So actually all the success came from a failure.
That's really cool. It's
fascinating.
It's motivating.
Yeah. So this guy, Kipchoge, which I think pretty much even in the non-running world, people have heard of him now. The reason you've heard of him is because he failed to get into the team.
And do you think maybe failing is the thing that is giving you more strength to go for it? Because this story is kind of similar to Lucy Charles Barkley.
Mm.
When
good point. Yeah, so
well who's she?
Yeah, no, you can explain in Lucy Charles Barkley.
I mean, she's a triathlete that basically last year, I think 2023, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She won the world championship in the Ironman competition
after about 3 runners-up medals. Yeah,
she was really looking to get this one.
Yeah.
And I've heard about her story that mm-hmm. apparently she was a swimmer since she was in the high school,
yeah.
And then her dream was to just go to the Olympics to do the butterfly, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then she wasn't selected by the Olympic Committee, the UK one.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was kind of giving up.
Mm.
And then I think it was her husband, the one who decided, like, okay, we need a new challenge.
Yeah.
We're going to sign up to do an Ironman. And then I think on her first Ironman, she was qualified for the World the World Championship mm-hmm. of the Ironman.
Yeah.
And then it was on her first World Championship when she got like second or third or something mm-hmm. like that. The one that was in Kona, I think it
yep.
was.
Yeah.
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 And everything came from a failure, which is really interesting because you can need something to.
Yeah. I mean, for me, and again, I must admit, I don't really know the science behind the psychology of a failure and stuff. I have to say that. But I think that if you're someone, so some people would have, say Kipchoge, some people would have just given up, you know. Same with Lucy Charles Barkley. Some people would have not got selected for the Olympics and said, I'm going to go do whatever now. But I think for the people that truly, you know, truly have that something within them, and I don't really know how to describe, and it sounds even a bit lame, truly have that drive to succeed, the failure, although hurts them, it doesn't become too much for them. They're the kind of people that they have to have an abnormally hard challenge, otherwise they just don't see the point.
And I think in a way it makes them stronger of how they used to be, because I'm not saying that before they were not, but maybe this is giving them more motivation. Like, I didn't achieved that thing mm-hmm. in the past. Mm. Now I really, really, really want to achieve this.
Yeah, possibly. It could be that, yeah. I just think with people like this, it's they just have something really within them. I mean, if you've listened to interviews of some of these people, so Mo Farah, he's Team GB athlete, Olympic champion, multiple times, extraordinary athlete. He's now retired recently. And if you listen to him in interviews, if he didn't win a race, like, he was like, I now have to destroy myself till I win. You know, that was just how these people thought. And to a certain extent, it might be their downfall, but it also just might be the reason why they become Olympic champion, you know?
Yeah. I mean, is that some of these things, even when you're young and you're at school and the teachers, if you're doing well, you're always okay, but if you're not doing well, that they're saying that you never achieve that. The moment you do it, it's like, I would really like to talk to you.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't know, it's something that grows in you that you feel like they need to, maybe now I do this for myself, or maybe I do it for someone else, but I really want to make it.
Yeah.
And make the team, make the Olympics, or make whatever you want to do, and be the person of the moment.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's really absolutely remarkable. Gosh.
But yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, particularly in sport now, you're seeing a lot of, so that almost toxic mentality of I have to win, that seems to actually be slowly changing. If you look at the media, you see a lot of you're seeing a lot more frequent headlines of there's a toxic culture in the swimming world, there's a toxic culture, all these types of things, and it's this kind of win at all costs mentality is almost being punished. You know, it's almost being right, this is too excessive. Because if someone says to you, I have to win, like I have to win, then to a certain extent there's something strange about that, because what if you don't win? There can only be one winner, right? There's only one Olympics, and it's every 4 years. You know, something could happen between now and that's what. And if your mentality is you have to win, well, what if you don't? Now, what do you do with your life? Do you see what I'm going?
Yeah.
And it is dangerous, and I think that's partly why it's maybe changing a little bit.
Yeah, and also if you don't get chosen, it's not just winning or not. Maybe working during those 4 years to make it to the Olympics, and then actually not being selected.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because for some sports, I think they do like a trial. For the USA, the marathon, they do a trial. But I think for the UK, they didn't do a trial.
No, they do, yeah.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay. Maybe I heard that wrong, but for certain sports, I think they don't do a trial. They just choose
They probably do, to be fair. Well, maybe, I don't know. But you're right, sometimes it can get a bit political when it comes to, if there's no kind of binary, you made the qualification time or you didn't. You know, if it's, well, we like this person more, maybe we choose them, that's maybe, yeah, not good.
Yeah, no, that's insane. Should we move on to the next one?
Mm.
As you can tell, we are starting with some topic and we ended up with a completely different one, but that's okay. Okay, now to cycling. Let's move to cycling. There's a really, really controversial helmet going on around there. Do you want to explain a bit more about this?
Yeah, so recently, probably everyone in the cycling world by now has seen these pictures online of these, I guess you could describe them as shark heads or bullet train style helmets. And well, the UCI is, so I think the UCI have now just banned them until they've done their own testing and they decided that these helmets are safe. The other thing that these things were doing is they had what they were calling a headstock, which I think was essentially kind of a piece of fabric that I think connected from the skin suit that you wear, which is the super tight material. And it went all the way up, covered most of your face, kind of like this, so that any air that did hit your face, the aero suit would make it, the air go by smoother. And the problem is, if you look at pictures, the suit kind of comes right up to their eyes like this. So if I look at the camera, it almost covers their eyes. So if it kind of, if something happened and it covered an eye at 50 kilometers an hour, you're going straight into a wall.
Really, really sad.
Well, and that's what the UCI doesn't like. So I love innovation. And I when I saw these pictures, I thought it was super cool. And I was a big fan. I thought it was great. But obviously, safety has to come first.
Yeah,
it just does. And so I think they're going to determine if these helmets are safe. But, I mean, you would have seen the pictures from the team. The team names probably changed. But Lotto Visma, the yellow team. Every team is wearing these kind of shark head style helmets now. And it looks like they're just going to get rid of them until they've decided that they are safe to wear. Which is probably fair.
Sorry, yeah. I even heard that I saw on the internet that someone, well, many people was commenting that when they first saw the pictures, they thought it was AI. They didn't think it was real, which is insane.
That's funny.
Mean, the helmet doesn't look real in a way.
I mean, I've seen a lot of strange things come out of the cycling world in terms of technology and stuff. So I wasn't surprised to see it. Yeah, I didn't think it was AI. I believed it.
No, but it's definitely a really peculiar
helmet. Yeah, but I mean, it's cool though. I like it. I like these new random innovations. Yeah. I think it's cool.
Do you think they really make a difference wearing that helmet?
It probably does, but the difference would be very, very small. Mm. So if you're a recreational time trialer, you don't need this helmet to be better. There are other ways to get better, but it probably does. I mean, aero helmets do make a difference, that is for sure. I don't know what the testing results of those, the brand that made that helmet, but it probably does make a slight difference, yeah.
Another thing is that I'm guessing they need to be quite light.
Mm-hmm.
But just looking at that helmet, it didn't look like it was light. It looks like really bulky.
It would have been very light. Yeah. If you picked it up, it would have felt like you're holding something you could just throw really high up in the air.
Oh, gosh.
It's made of... what's the material? I can't remember the name of the materials, but they're very, very light.
Yeah. Gosh, that's just insane. Okay, should we move on to the next section?
Why not?
I have no idea for how long we've been talking already, because the time, it doesn't save me the time, but I'm guessing quite a while, so let's move on to the next section.
Oh, it says on the camera.
And the next section is going to be analysis of some of the material. This week we're going to talk about shoes, running shoes in particular, but maybe for the following weeks we're going to vary and do something else. I mean, obviously, so we're not talking about the same thing every week. The first thing that I would like to cover is the really famous that everyone is trying to find an answer for, shoe rotation, the perfect shoe rotation.
Gosh, does that even exist? Well, so I guess the first question is, do you need a shoe rotation? And you don't need a shoe rotation, but it would help optimize your training. But running shoes now, they're very expensive. And let's be honest, most people can't afford to have five different pairs of running shoes. And the good thing is, you don't need five pairs of running shoes, but it would help you a little bit if you have the right rotation. So this is how I'm going to begin. You'll often see online people say the shoe rotation you need is your daily trainer, which is the one you use most days, your easy shoe, your recovery shoe, your tempo run and your intervals, then your race day. That's six different shoes. Now, that's wrong. You don't look at your shoe rotation in that kind of way. So, for example, your daily shoe and your easy shoe, in theory, are the same thing because most of your runs should be easy. So you don't need an easy shoe and a daily shoe. That just doesn't make sense. Your recovery shoe, well, you possibly would want a shoe maybe with extra cushion, but this is still not the right approach. The right approach is you want different shoes that work your muscles differently. So, for example, I could have those six shoes, and none of them work my muscles differently. They could all be the same style, high stack height, a high drop, all these types of features, right? They could all be very similar. And so you're not giving your muscles a different stimulus. So for example, let's say, okay, so here's something. Shoes that are you know, flat, so have a low drop, say 4 millimeters, and are really firm, these shoes are often referred to as just flats. They are really, really good for improving your running economy. And your running economy is the amount of oxygen you're using for a given intensity. So runners who use cushion shoes, your running economy will still increase, but it won't increase as much compared to using firm shoes. So those people relying on your recovery shoe, your daily trainer shoe, your easy shoe, probably all of which are cushion shoes, you may be not optimizing your training. You maybe want to consider including a shoe that's quite firm, has a low drop, and that will help you. That will help improve your running economy a bit more. Because if you think about it, if there's less cushion, then when you hit your foot on the floor, your knees and your muscles are having to do more of the work as the braking force compared to the cushion shoe, where the cushion will do more of it for you. So your body isn't working as hard. And naturally, if your body isn't working as hard, you're not improving as much. So you don't necessarily need to think in terms of what type of workout, you need to think of what type of stimulus are you giving your muscle. So if I look at myself, for example, I have shoes that are quite firm, I have shoes that are quite soft, and then I have a pair of carbon shoes. Now, if I'm really, really, really tired, I'll actually use my, and my muscles really hurt, I'll actually use my race day shoes, my carbon shoes, as my recovery shoes. And the reason is because, well, guess what? The carbon will help do a lot of the work for you. Not literally, obviously, I'm exaggerating that, but they will help you a lot. So that sounds to me like a good recovery shoe because I need a bit of help. My muscles are aching, but I still need to do my workout, so I can use my recovery shoes.
No, I heard about that, using your race day shoe.
Yeah, so if the week after a race, you're really tired, but you just want to do a little bit, do a maintenance week, let's say, using your carbon shoes might not be a bad idea because they're going to help you do some of that running for you without you having to do extra work compared to, say, using the firm shoes. And then for me, let's say that you have a slight Achilles problem. If you have an Achilles injury, stopping actually doesn't help the injury. You need to continue running. You need to continue putting pressure on it. Not an excessive amount, obviously, but you need to continue putting pressure on it. Otherwise, the Achilles just gets weaker and then it will more likely get injured. Let's say you do have an Achilles injury. You then can use a shoe with a high stack height and a low drop because that puts a little bit less pressure on your Achilles. So that's an example of how you should be thinking in your shoe rotation, using different shoes for different muscles, different injuries you may have, and different adaptations. So that's how I see it. So when I see online these things like, oh, you need a tempo run shoe. Do I need a tempo run shoe? Because I have a pair of shoes that I could use for literally anything. It's not a tempo run shoe. It's, you don't need that. That's not how you think of it. That's the wrong mentality.
I guess that's more psychologically that you feel that the shoe is going to make you faster. So psychologically, you're going to feel like you're going faster.
Maybe it's called good marketing.
Maybe. Yeah. Because I remember I used to work in a running shoe shop for almost a year. Yeah. Now it's been a while, so I'm not that updated on the shoes that has been releasing recently.
Yeah.
But I had the chance to try many different ones. I'm obviously team super, super, super cushiony shoe. And I like that. And even some brands that they're offering or going out into the market saying that, oh, this is my most cushioned shoe from my brand. Yeah. After I was like, are you joking, right? How is this cushion?
Yeah.
No, I've tried shoes that they're not the most cushiony shoe from other brands. And they have way more cushion than that. But for example, for me, in my case, I've kind of always struggle to find the perfect ones for me because I feel like they're kind of all doing the same, unless it's really obvious. I have a nylon plate one that I tend to use for my tempo runs, so the interval stays. And that one, I really see the difference. I can really tell you that. But it can also be because the other ones, they are too worn out because I don't really keep track of my shoes. I know they're only supposed to be like 600, 700 kilometers. But probably, man, they have way, way, way more.
Well, at least carbon-plated shoes, I think you have about 250 miles before the carbon plate. The tension in it is not as tight. So you want the plate to have a really tight, you want it to be really stiff. And the stiffer the plate, in theory, the faster you go. And I don't, 250 miles, what's that in kilometers? That's about 450 kilometers, roughly. So that's about how long those shoes will last. With nylon plates, difference between a nylon plate and a carbon plate, the material, obviously, for one.
And I think it's cheaper.
It's cheaper. I think part of the reason it's cheaper is it's a little bit heavier. So carbon sheets are obviously lighter and faster. And they're not quite as stiff. And I think that those are the two differences. So that's why they're not quite as, I guess, fast as the carbon shoe. But again, I personally don't like using plated shoes in training. Save that for two things. One, race day, obviously. And two, some training sessions in the build-up to race day, because you need the specificity of using the shoe. Because carbon shoes, they're very strange shoes. They're not designed to be very comfortable. They're not designed to feel like you can wear them all day. They're designed to make you go fast. And so you want to practice wearing these shoes in some of your key workouts as specificity, because your training needs to be specific. And those are really the only two circumstances. Or if you're recovering, so three, if you need for an extra boost when you're recovering. So really, there are only three main circumstances I'd recommend wearing plated shoes. Otherwise, I'm not a huge fan, personally, at least in training. I would rather wear shoes that result in more adaptation than wear shoes that will make me fast in training. I don't necessarily need to be fast in training. I need to be faster on race day. You see?
But I think you can feel the need of feeling that you're fast or you're prepared for the race. Maybe those shoes, psychologically, they're going to make you feel that way. Because there was... Oh, I don't remember who it was. It was a Spanish trail runner. I think it was Mikel Corbera.
Okay.
No, I'm actually not remember who
he was. Okay, that's right.
But he was supposed to do a race, and he didn't perform well. This was recently.
Yeah.
And he didn't perform as well as he was expecting. And he was saying that he had another race in a couple of weeks. And like, I'm not feeling like my best version. Mm. And I want to see myself my best version just before the important race, the A race. So he signed up for... Oh, no, I know who he was.
Who is it? Who is it?
Andres.
Oh, well, that was obvious.
And he said that he was going to sign up for another... Andres is another trail runner in Spain, by the way. Andres Garcia. And he was going to sign up for another race before the A race in a couple of weeks to actually feel that he performed well.
Yeah.
And he can perform well, and he's at his first version. He want to psychologically believe that he is before going into that race, because mentally it kind of puts you off a bit. Saying like, oof, I didn't perform well. Maybe I'm not going to perform well at this one too.
Yeah, I mean, psychology would absolutely play an impact in this. The system I actually use for me personally is, let's say I'm training for a half marathon, and 2 weeks before the half marathon, I have a warm-up race, you know, a B race, and let's say it's a 10K. Now, let's say the race goes really badly, and I'm struggling to even maintain my half marathon pace in the 10K. That's a disaster, right? The way I look at it is, if I know my training's been good and my training and I've been mostly hitting my numbers and the race didn't go well, I look at it and go, instead of hitting the panic button, I look at it and go, okay, everyone performs badly sometimes. I've just got my bad performance out of the way, because I'm unlikely to perform bad twice in a row. So I've just got my bad one out of the way. Now, if I perform well, I look at it and go, well, I'm going well then. So in my head, I think I can't lose today on my warm-up race. Because if it goes badly, I get the bad one out of the way. And if it goes well, then I know I'm going well. You know, it's just that so if we talk about the psychology behind it, it's this, I use that small trick that says, well, it's a win-win today because I can't lose, you know?
No, but going back to the main topic about the shoes is that, you can sign up to a race to actually feel like you're doing well. But if maybe you don't have the chance or for whatever reason you don't want to go for a race, maybe on training you want to show that or actually believe yourself that.
Yeah.
So actually maybe going with a faster shoe
will
make you believe that because you're performing better at training. So like, I'm actually...
Yeah, but it's... That wouldn't really work because ultimately it's possible you'd be faster if you didn't keep wearing the plated shoes.
No, I'm not talking about the plated shoes. I'm just talking for the... a shoe that you think the thing is that the carbon plated just for races that's obviously although I'm seeing lately a lot of people on social media wearing carbon plated shoes for training when they have to do their tempo runs on intervals. It's becoming quite popular.
Good for them.
Yeah, I mean, they might be influencers. Yeah, they get garbage, and she's like, as if it was nothing. So it's like, I don't mind using it for training. But yeah, they tend to be really expensive. But just using a shoe that you feel like make you go a bit faster. It doesn't have to be a 200 one.
Yeah.
It can be, I'm not sure if we should be talking about brands.
Maybe not, yeah.
Yeah, but there's some really good shoes out there that they are just really speedy and really springy, and it has this push feeling.
Yeah.
That
responsive.
Yeah, responsive. Yeah. That would make you feel like really, really good with it, and you don't feel the need to wear carbon plated. But it's a shoe that is light. It kind of has that same feeling.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm gonna wear it just to feel like, even if it's on an easy run, it's like just to feel like I'm bombing today.
Well, that's nice. Whatever gives you the edge.
You use that or not really?
I use the shoe that I think would be best for that given day. I don't think about, I feel good in this shoe, so I'm gonna wear it. That's not really how I think about it. Yeah, I think about it more. I don't think about the psychology of that so much.
No. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's just me.
No, I'm sure you'll probably do a PV in a shoe that for the vast majority of people, it would be just, that's just my easy days shoe.
Yeah, probably. I did once, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was wearing some just shoes that I wear every day, mainly. Went to park run, and I think I got like a PV in that.
Yeah.
Who said you need carbon?
That's it.
I mean, you probably do, but anyway.
And I think we kind of covered the next one. That was the debate of about using carbon and nylon plate shoes for training. Not a huge fan of that, right?
In training, again, it's good under certain circumstances. One being for specificity of your training. So you're close to race day. You need to practice in the shoes you're going to race in. In the same way, you might need to practice your fueling for race day. You need to train your body to deal with these things. If you are particularly tired and you need a bit of an extra help recovery-wise, you can wear them. But yeah, in your general training, not really necessary, no. Yeah, that's what I think. But it does seem they will... There's a lot of individual variants, so some people might not benefit at all, really, from carbon shoes. Some people will benefit substantially. Because it does change your running gait a little bit. So not everyone benefits that much from carbon shoes. Some people will, some people won't, some people a little bit. So don't just think you buy carbon shoes and you go fast. That might not necessarily be the case.
And another thing that I would like to point out is that, at least talking from experience, nowadays there are some shoes that they are becoming really popular because you see them all over social media.
Yeah.
Because they look nice. Especially for girls, I say that. Just because, well, and for guys too. Like, you see a really good looking shoe, I want that one.
Yeah.
But that might not be the shoe for you. Because I had also a lot of friends that now they're getting into running, and they're like, oh, I really want this shoe because look how pretty it is. Like, are you sure that's the right one for you?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this actually. There was some research that came out and actually said running shoes don't cause injury.
Mm-hmm.
And you often hear people say, I wore these shoes and I got injured.
But it doesn't necessarily be that. Like, for example, I recently realized that I have quite wide feet.
Yeah.
I also, they were normal, but apparently they are quite wide. There are some shoes and some brands that they are really, really narrow.
Uh-huh.
For example, I had one shoe that I only wore twice because it was literally like too narrow for my feet. But it looks nice, so everyone... It's a really popular brand that everyone wants.
Yeah.
And really colourful. And it's quite narrow for my feet, but just that specific shoe, because there are some others from the same brand that I had that I really love.
Yeah.
And... No, actually, it's not that brand. It's another one. But that one, for me, was not working, but some other shoes from the same brand, they were working. And that's what really, really popular on social media. But it was not the right one for me. Maybe for the drop, that could be, it was really low drop and not really used to that. It was kind of comfortable in that. And it was quite firm for me, even though it was sold as really cushiony. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But for me, it was just not the right shoe because it was too narrow and it was creating me blisters. And it was not for the socks. I know that. I wore proper socks. I had bad experiences with some cotton-based socks. But it was just about the shoe, that thing. And for you... I don't know. I think you also had some bad experiences with some shoes at the beginning.
I think all the shoes I've bought, I wear.
But I'm pretty sure. The very, very first
one. Well, so when I, before I really understood what a shoe rotation should look like, I kind of fell into the trap of, oh, I only want to wear a cushioned shoe because it's comfortable. Mm-hmm. This was a while ago. But I've learned that, you know, that's not how you should think of the shoes. And that the shoes that are maybe as comfortable and give you as nice a foot underground can give you the same ride, but you still need that in your rotation. That's why I use all the shoes that I buy, that I bought.
Yeah, but I think it would also be the stability of the shoe, because there's some people that have some problems with that. That not everyone is neutral.
Well, everyone... So if you look at even professional runners, some of them will, I guess, you know, pronate quite a lot, but they don't wear support shoes. Now, I don't actually know a huge amount about pronation and the effects of all that on the shoe and your running stride, but I know everyone does pronate a little bit, and the reason is because it acts as a slight shock absorber. Mm-hmm. So it's healthy to have a little bit in there, and it's normal for that to be the case. Do you need a support shoe if you pronate a lot? The short answer is, I don't know. I'm not sure.
I mean, I think you really benefit from that, because maybe you carry a lot of problems that could easily be avoided. But just having a, maybe not necessarily a stable shoe, like a stability shoe, but maybe some that is still neutral but more stable. There are some brands that, let's be honest, they are really, really unstable. And the problem with the vast majority of carbon shoes is that they are really unstable. I had one colleague when I was working at the running shop that he really wanted some carbon shoes. But the problem that he had is that there were no stability carbon shoes,
but
sportive ones.
But the thing is, did he, when he wore those shoes, did he get any serious problems from them?
I think he put insoles inside the carbon shoes. That's the only option, because there's no supportive carbon shoes out there.
I mean, I'm going to go away and find out if not having supportive shoes when you pronate a lot is a problem. Because here's a question for you. When you were working at the running shop, how did you decide if someone was a pronator or not? Because as far as I'm concerned, there isn't really a threshold for what's considered pronation. Some people say if it pronates 15 degrees, that's you're a pronator. But all these people don't actually measure the angle and say categorically you are a pronator and need shoes. They just eyeball it, so yeah. It's not even accurate. I think it's really flawed.
You were just putting people into a treadmill and then filming them.
This is partly why I think the whole pronation thing is, I'm just not convinced by it.
Yeah, I mean, but to be fair, I had a lot of customers that they were coming and they were pretty happy with some shoes that maybe they've been using for years, and they literally stopped having some issues for that, for those shoes. The thing is, it's quite tricky for the employees, because you don't know the past of the person that is coming to you. And if actually that's going to stop those pains, because it could be for a thousand reasons. Mm. But definitely it's an improvement. Mm. And I had a friend, Pepe.
Yeah.
And she was having some issues with the shoes she had, because they were quite unstable and really, really narrow. Mm-hmm. And then I recommended her another brand, and she just grew up a couple of days ago. They're like, they feel like a completely different shoe. This is really stable, really cushiony, and they feel really comfortable. And I think for a runner that is not trying to take it professionally, it's just like every once in a while, like she's doing twice per week, going out for a run for a 5K. That would really make the difference, because you just want to feel comfortable in what you're wearing.
Yeah.
You're not really
I mean, that's fair enough. Yeah.
I don't know. We are almost 50 minutes. This is going really quickly, and we haven't even covered the last section. So we tried to keep it short. We're going to try to aim for an hour or so, for at least for this first episode. Then we don't know. So let's introduce the last section. Now it's time for the interview. Although we've been talking for a while, I'm not sure how many questions we could be answering right now. But I guess I'm going to talk a bit about my experience, because you're my coach. Mm-hmm. And you've been coaching me now for almost a year.
Exactly a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Exactly 1 year.
Yeah, at the beginning of March last year.
Yeah.
And yeah. It has been really interesting, this journey, mm-hmm. because it's the first time I'm been taking seriously running. I started running after COVID, like the vast majority of people. And then I was kind of on and off. It was kind of an on and off thing. And then I decided to take it more seriously, like a year ago when you started coaching me.
Yeah.
I remember the first few months I was a bit skeptical because I was really, really scared of getting injured because I had a past with that, getting injured. Because, I mean, to be honest, I was a bit all over the place. And I was the kind of person who was thinking, like, I cannot run 2 days in a row because otherwise I'm going to get injured. Like, no, no, that's not for me. I don't know how the people who are doing that, they're crazy. No, 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 you need rest days in between. And now here I am after a year running 6 out of the 7 days.
Yeah, I mean, the transformation view has been quite impressive. You have not been injured to a point where you need to miss training, not once in the past year, which really goes to show, although injuries are natural and over the course of your career, you're going to get injured, if you really closely monitor the athlete, injuries can be reduced substantially. And that's something I think I'm quite pleased that that's something we've achieved. You've had a couple of illnesses, which isn't too bad in a year for an athlete, and no proper injuries. Very impressive.
No, and I think also another thing that I was quite like shocked at the beginning is that before I used to get, I think it was 3 days per week running, maybe some weeks 4, but it was longer sessions. Mm. And the change with you is that now you're putting me like more sessions. The vast majority of days I'm doing like twice, 2 sessions in a day, even some days 3. But they are really short. Mm. There must be like once a week or 1 or 2 per week that they are a bit more with a bit more intensity.
Uh-huh.
But the vast majority, they are really short.
Yeah.
They are really easy. So obviously you're getting tired as the day's going. But naturally, everyone else would get tired after the day's going. But I think that's the main change for me, like doing more, but shorter.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'd recommend for pretty much anyone. Unless you literally couldn't train, or you could only train 3 days a week, let's say. The aim is to train, instead of, let's say, a lot of people there, you won't train during the week, and then they'll do a whole bunch on the weekend. Mm. It's going to take you 2-3 days to recover from that. Then for the next 2 days till the weekend, 2-3 days till the weekend, you're detraining, because you're not training. Then you put on a big load again over the weekend. And if you do that for a month or two, you might get better for a month or two. But after that, you won't see many improvements after that. So particularly in cycling, you hear the term weekend warriors a lot. These people that don't do any riding during the week, and then at the weekend, they go do some big rides. And that's fine. That's great. You know, it gets you outside, does get you being physically active. But it won't get you to be better over a longer period of time. The best way would be to, let's say you do a 5-hour on the Sunday. You could split that 5 hours into a 5-hour training week and then slowly increase that to 6 hours, 7 hours, and you'd get better that way. You'd get better for longer that way. And that would be a better way to design your training. And that's what we started doing with you.
Yeah, it was slowly because at the beginning I was at like 30, 40 kilometers per week.
Yeah, not many.
Yeah, and that was the usual, and now I'm ending like the vast majority of weeks, around 80 or so.
Well, like, yeah, 80 to 100.
Yeah.
Yeah, 80 to 100K a week.
No, this week I'm supposed to do 100.
Yeah, and last week you did 100. And that's happened a little quicker than I expected.
Yeah.
But that's because I was comfortable that if we increase things, it's one thing saying, okay, if I increase your volume now, will you burn out in a month? That's not necessarily the question I want to ask. The question is, if I increase your volume now, and then presumably I'll increase it again in the future, will those increases result in burnout sooner in the next year, let's say? Because you're going to get a little bit burnt out in the short term, then you recover from that, then you adapt. But if is this trend, say the trend is let's say it's a 30% increase in your volume per month, is that trend going to result in burnout that's going to be too much to recover from. And I don't think the rate at which we've increased your training will result in any burnout. That's going to kind of ruin you. So I'm comfortable that the workload is within a range you can handle. But that's because we've monitored that. And the main thing is we've monitored that two main ways. One is using numbers, your training data. And the other one, and equally as important, is using your own feedback. Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing me telling you what the numbers say. It's a much different thing you telling me what you tell me. Mm-hmm. And that is probably a bit more important than anything I read on the data.
Yeah, because sometimes the data can be wrong if you don't have the good equipment to record it. Because I remember, and now I have a arm heart rate monitor, and that changed my life literally. Because before I was just recording my heart rate with my watch, mm-hmm. which by the way is nonsense, at least mine, because I have a really big watch for my small wrist.
Yeah.
So he was saying that in my easy runs, I was going at 180, and I was like, that's not possible. Yeah, 180, no chance. I should be mostly dying. Yeah. That's a race day heart rate.
Yeah.
And I was able to have a conversation, so it was really easy, everything. So, like, that doesn't make sense. And then I got a heart rate monitor, and then it was like, no, actually, you're 138, 140, which is a massive difference. So, huge. If you are relying on those numbers just from that, it would be like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that's why the way I look at it is I actually look at Formula One and the driver and the engineer. You're the driver, I'm the engineer. I engineer your training, you drive it. And if you look at what Formula One drivers have to do, they're so particular in their feedback with the car because there's like 1,000 moving parts in these things. And they'll give really precise feedback. So it might be lap 57, turn 4, the car oversteered ever so slightly. So how do you even know that it oversteered?
Exactly.
And then they have to memorize all these things through a 92-hour-minute race. And then they literally, after every race, they go through it and they discuss it and they go through all these tiny things in the car. And I see that the same thing with the athletes. So let's say you do a long run. Or when I was cycling, I would remember everything that happened. So I'd come back from a 3-hour ride. Okay, after 45 minutes on this climb, my right glute kind of hurt. Things like this. And it's like all these small things. And I write it all down. And then I have a really enormous file of information that I've collected over time of what I thought or how I felt the training was going. And that was great for a number of reasons. Not only was it great for the coach, it was great to reflect upon years to come, but it was also really great in teaching me how to learn how my body was feeling. Because one thing I always recommend is you want to be able to kind of train blind. I kind of refer to training blind. It basically means you're training without the data. So in other words, you know how hard you're going without any numbers. Because let's be honest, our numbers could be wrong. You just said your heart rate was 180. If your heart rate was 180, I'd be telling you to slow down by a lot. But you knew it wasn't 180 because you could feel it wasn't. You were having a conversation. You were recovering just fine from those workouts. You weren't coming home dead. And that's why you need to learn how to do that, and recording that and really thinking about it really helps doing that, and it makes a huge impact on your training in the long run.
Definitely. And also, you can share it with your coach, but I think it's really beneficial just like keeping track for yourself. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not that good with that.
Yeah.
I used to have a diary and put it every day after training peaks, but then I got a bit lazy and stopped doing that. I was just telling you.
Yeah.
But I think it could be quite beneficial, because now I look back and let's say in 3 years, even just for the memories in 3 years, because I was keeping a diary during the summer, which was when I did the 100K on the bike for the first time.
Yeah.
I started cycling this summer, and I didn't even know how to ride a bike. I still don't know how to fix a bike. So if I get a puncture, I'm done. I'm done with my life. But now I roughly know how to ride a bike. So I remember when I did my first 100K, I came home like so excited.
Yeah.
And putting that in the diary with actually the feelings I had and the thing that happened. I know in a few years I'm going to really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Going back to that, it's like, oh gosh.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely very useful to give yourself some good historical kind of
milestones.
Milestones and even historical data. So if you have a problem later in life, let's say, you can look back and read all of that and say, that's interesting. There were some early warning signs that I didn't know that's what they meant till later. And now you can look back and say, ah, that's interesting, because now I can look out for that in the future because I know it's a warning sign, you see, and that's really helpful.
Yeah, and also about a certain piece of equipment, because I remember one shoes that I didn't like at the beginning, then I let them be there for months, and then when I took them again, it's like, oof, it seems to be weird.
Yeah.
And then if I had recorded that, maybe I would have knew if it was maybe a problem that I was feeling that day, or maybe a problem I had since the first day in the shoe, because I didn't even remember why I was not wearing those shoes that just stayed. It's like, I think I just didn't like it, but for the day there.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely, definitely.
And then another thing that I would say is that is a big difference for me is that I started cross training, which I think is vital, at least in my case, because let's put these people in context. I'm a trail runner and I live in a flat city. There's no hills around. Well, the only hills that high hill that we have is like a 400-meter hill.
It's nothing really, yeah.
Not of elevation, 400 in distance.
Yeah, it's nothing really.
And it must be like, I don't know, 20 meters of elevation or so. And I remember in the first few days you were putting me like 214 times this. Like, I'm not sure how this is going to work.
Yeah.
And it was a bit exhausting. But since I started to use the bike more, I think that really helped.
Yeah.
Especially because at least on the bike, I can put the elevation.
Yeah.
Because otherwise running, I would not be able to do that. And the only time I put in the elevation when running is when I go to Spain. Or, when I go to one mountainy plane, which is...
Yeah, I mean, in terms of cross-training... cycling is one of the best tools a runner can use, and you're seeing it now amongst the professionals. Even some of them are beginning to do this because it's an excellent way to increase the strength of your cardiovascular system without increasing the mechanical load on your body. Because when you're running a large mechanical load, you don't really get that in cycling, and that's really, really beneficial. And I think that's helped you a lot. You know, increase the size of your heart, for example, increase your blood volume. Do all these things about increasing the amount you're running, and well, we obviously have done that, but not to a point where it might be too much. Yeah,
but I think that's important, using that cross training base if you have the time. Because for me, in my case, I mean, I don't mind you keeping me like 30 hours per week. I would do that.
Yeah.
I need that training, but for some other people, maybe that they have more responsibilities like kids or staff.
I mean, even if you did, you might want to say you could only run five times a week. Even then, I would consider swapping one of those runs for a bike ride. Yeah, an hour on the turbo indoors instead of a run. I would just think about it. It depends, of course, on your injury history, your current phase and your training, but something for you to think about, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how about also putting some strength and some gym work?
So this could really be a whole other episode talking about this. But
maybe we'll leave it for the next
episode. Should we leave it for the next one as a bit of a cliffhanger?
Okay. We're already 1 hour and something.
We'll leave it as a cliffhanger.
Yeah. I'll make a
next
note.
Time.
I'll make a note here.
Next time.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's cool.
I think... Yeah, those were basically the main change. I mean, it was the volume. It was the intensity, because everything is easy now. Or at least feels easy.
Yeah.
At least the runs are easy runs. Sometimes maybe I'm pushing a bit more than you. But they're supposed to be easy runs.
Yes.
And then the cross training. And I think it was also the mindset that I've changed.
Yeah, I think that'd be quite useful. Again, we'll discuss it another week, I think.
Yeah.
But to talk about how maybe you are the one holding yourself back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because for me, unless I see results, I don't tend to believe in what I'm doing, which is kind of
not unreasonable,
annoying.
But
it's really annoying.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to see a result until you've kind of believe, or until you prove yourself that you can do it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a circle that it never ends. But I think overall this was a really good first episode. Have enjoyed it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think it was really cool, and we covered a lot of things, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I hope for the next ones we have some more interesting stuff.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We'll improve some things, hopefully, because we are just starting this.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else that you would like to add?
No, I'm happy with that. Yeah. We'll talk more in the next one.
Yes. Which, by the way, when are we going to be uploading this stuff?
Soon.
Yeah.
Shortly.
You don't know the date, you're right.
Coming soon.
Every Sunday. Every Sunday. Yes. Every Sunday night, we will be uploading our episodes. So, yeah, I hope you really enjoy it. Thank you so much for listening to us, and see you in the next episode of the
BCA podcast.
Exactly.